This week I'm joined by Jason Horsley, who is the author of Seen and Not Seen, Confessions of a Movie Autist, Prisoner of Infinity, and The Vice of Kings. He has a weekly podcast called The Liminalist, The Podcast Between, and a blog which is linked in the description below. In this episode, we discuss his book Prisoner of Infinity in relation to social engineering and trauma. If you wish to support Hermetics Podcast, please find the Patreon, merchandise, and donation links in the description below. Enjoy. Jason Horsley, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics.
Oh, well, thanks for the invitation. What do I call you? Meta Nomad.
That is the one. Or James. People do know my first name, so that's fine. Okay. So before we start with the Hermetics question, if you could tell us a little bit about your background and kind of what you're writing about and what you're kind of directing yourself towards in terms of your writing.
Okay. Well, I just did a summary, actually, for my YouTube channel, also for this book proposal that I'm putting together. So, although I'm not sure I want to actually read from it, because that might be a bit stilted, I'm going to try and refer to it, because it's very hard for me to sum up what I do, but I'm kind of forced to as I try and write book proposals and things of that sort. So I juxtapose like two areas of research, one that started 40 years ago, which was my immersion in or enthrallment to Hollywood, to movies, movie culture. And the other that came about a decade later, so that's 30 years ago, was my fascination for the hidden aspects of reality, whether that's sorcerous, occult, or spiritual, or parapolitical, you know, deep state machinations that gets kind of all lumped together under conspiracy theory, whether that's a selling hook or whether that's a way to dismiss it. So the intersection between those two areas of interest, and then all in the context of what I call the inner penetrating landscapes of the psyche and culture at large. And then the objective, which I'm a bit more hesitant to put into words, but I'd say is to identify the cultural implants that have generated this false identity and that have uncoupled us from our life force. So I'm really trying to reclaim my life force and rediscover who I actually am. So it's very traditional spiritual quest stuff, but not approached traditionally, I guess. In some ways, I do.
Do you think that because as you say, that is a fairly traditional kind of quest, the quest to go back to an authentic self or some form of legitimate being before it's been tarnished or changed or altered or mutated by something. Do you think that is more or less difficult now that I think in some ways the mechanisms which are altering us, so I always use the term modernity, they seem clearer. Do you think this is true, or do you think it's just as muddled as it always was?
The mechanisms seem clearer because they're more, well, I think it's both actually, because they've become more sophisticated, and so they've become more kind of prevalent and more proactive in terms of the cultural indoctrination and the technology and all the rest of it. But by the same token, because they're more prevalent and more sophisticated, we might think we can see them, but we're probably not seeing the subtler aspects of it. But just like they say about the military, that they, you know, whatever technology that they're letting us know and about and putting on the market, we can probably safely surmise that the technology they actually have, you know, is 30 years ahead of what we're seeing, kind of thing. I don't know how exactly that's true.
But so they kind of, they wouldn't allow someone to own something which they couldn't beat.
Right. I mean, something like Google Earth. I mean, how long have they had that technology via satellites to observe everything on the planet before they gave it to the rest of us? It's safe to guess that it's at least a decade or two, and perhaps more. So in this regard, I think, and with the spiritual endeavor and the obstacles to really to autonomy and freedom, they seem to have become greater and greater, I would say. So the challenge has become greater. I'd say the opportunity is greater, but I think overall, I'd say we're living in more difficult, more problematic times than any other time in human history. That would be my guess.
Tough question, but do you feel you've made any headway towards your task there, towards retaining your life force, as you put it?
Reclaiming.
Yeah,
well, if I didn't, I would have been in terrible shape, because I actually have had many decades. I suppose I can't talk about many because I'm only 50, but at least a couple of decades where I thought I was making headway, and I realized with hindsight that I wasn't. I was spinning my wheels. But I also realized that process of wheel spinning and the delusion that I was making progress moving forward, you know, seeing that has itself, paradoxically or ironically, that's the progress I see. I've just become much more aware of my own internalized subterfuges and capacity for delusion. So I do suspect, well, logically, if I've identified a lot more of my delusions, it seems like I must be closer to reality, but that wouldn't be enough in itself, because who knows, there may be a never-ending source of delusions that we can generate. But I would say that there's also a felt experience of just being more at peace, more at home, less inhibited and less anxiety, specifically social anxiety, which I suffered from a lot, more comfortable in my body, just, you know, more content. There are real simple ways, and also I can gauge that by people that have known me for a long time. They've observed the changes that I've become a lot easier to be with, right? So based on that, I'd say, yeah.
I think before we kind of dive any deeper in there, it's time to ask you the hermetics question, which is if you can place three thinkers, living or dead, in a room and listen in on the conversation, who do you pick? And I'm extremely intrigued now as to who you pick, because there's so many connected to the task you've listed there. I'm wondering who would be the...
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question, a difficult one, because there's different ways you could answer it. So initially, I went to, you know, which conversation would I really want to listen in on, and that and including dead people, and it's so open ended, I would end up with something like Jesus Christ and Hitler and Dostoevsky or something. I don't know, you know, just what would seem like a really fascinating conversation. But I also know that you asked that question partly with the hope that it can be part of the discussion, that there's a way to juxtapose perspectives and come up with something more complete. So that was how I decided I would answer it, with three thinkers that I think are very influential in my understanding and who I could be made compatible. So they are René Girard, number one, who may have come up on your podcast before, I'm not sure, but his theory of the mimetic rivalry, mimetic desire, and the scapegoat mechanism has been very helpful, informative. The other is Donald Cowshed, who's not very well known, but he wrote a book called The Inner World of Trauma. He was a Jungian therapist, but he's not really, there's a lot of case studies, and his focus is on trauma and the effects of trauma on the psyche. And there is there's an overlap with the Jungian kind of archetypal view, because he maps the way that trauma-induced dissociation accesses these archetypal realms and the pros and cons of that. So anyway, so he's been very helpful to me. And the third one was Lloyd DeMaus, who... And ironically, considering I'm picking him, I haven't actually read any of his books all the way through. I've just read essays here and there. But he wrote a thing called The Emotional Life of Nations and History of Childhood, or Psychohistory of Childhood. I forget the exact name of the other one. But he's mapped childhood abuse throughout history and as being a formative factor that shaped our history, which I think is a great meta thesis. So anyway, those are the three that I picked, because I think that if they got together for a conversation, they really would be on the same page as compared to Hitler and Jesus, and they might actually work something out between them.
Okay. So the first one there, that Girard does relate to what you've already said, because this reclaiming of the life force is, in a way, This was something I mentioned, that John Michael Greer mentioned, which was that occultism and spiritualism, in a way, is a means to exit from cyclic patterns in history. So kind of, if you accept that history is cyclic and everything's kind of returning again, then occultism and finding the hidden meaning is a way out of that. And of course, Girard philosophizes of these memetic spirals and almost psychological loops that people are in, that they just kind of latch onto the next thing and everything's a meme. Is that how you read him? You spoke of deconstructing one's own delusions, and of course Girard is kind of really getting down to the core of it there, that often our delusions are our investment in a kind of popular current meme.
Yeah. Well, and our social identity, very much so. You know, we've learned a way of being just based on imitation, which, of course, we have to rely on as children. But if we have very poor models to imitate, then, because we get off to a bad start, you know. So even our way of imitating becomes compromised, you could say.
So then the connection between the thinkers there is that it would sort of be a critique of one's imitation as opposed to an actual critique of, well, I guess one's personality would be imitation. So, of course, this all connects already to your book, Prisoner of Infinity, which is this and your latest book, The Vice of Kings, is this part, I read both and saw them as kind of a series. Is that intentional? Because they aren't kind of directly connected, but there's so many threads that connect them that I'm assuming it is intended that way.
No, it's more retroactive, I'd say, or with hindsight. So even Seen and Not Seen, I know C is the first in that trilogy, but it was a trilogy that I only identified after I'd written the third part. Oh, there's a sequence here. So I think it's just a natural byproduct of my being engaged in a specific, you know, purpose and using writing to do so. So it's very like the medium is the message, comes to mind, a bit of a cliche, isn't it? Or one could say it's meta, but the way that what writing has become for me has determined the content, as in the way I've learned to use writing as a way to examine and identify my own cultural implants, and thereby the distortions and the, you know, the mimetic patterns that have alienated me from my life force, that has then, well, that's been inseparable from the kind of the subject that I've identified to write about. The books are, they're mapping a process of discovering, I suppose it is similar to what I said, like the way we, if we're going to get free of mimesis, we first of all have to identify the way that we've learned to imitate and how it's compromised us, because we do need some element of mimesis, just to survive, to be socialized beings, just as we need language. But we've also become imprisoned by language. And I say personally, I became particularly shackled to language as a writer, identified with it, the pen is mightier than the sword, that whole thing, the sublimation, you know, a way to kind of feel like I was expressing my libido, my life force, or my identity even through writing. That's a prison. Of course, that's the subject of Prisoner of Infinity, how Whitley Strieber did that. So then can I use that tool to get free of the prison? Just as can I find a model to imitate that will free me from the trap of mimesis? That's also part of the spiritual quest, isn't it?
It's interesting. It does tie in to the first question. So the book is kind of your own personal experience and personal trauma put alongside Whitley Strieber's his work, but largely his book Communion. And one of the things that he states, and you state many times, is that he believed, kind of in retrospect, which was also a large part of the horror, I think, for him, was that he was unleashing something on the world. So he'd created these fictional works and published them. And then once these had been created, these fictions had been allowed then to emanate throughout kind of collective society and within other people's minds, and people are then talking about this fiction, and it becomes something entirely different. So this links back to what you were saying there about the process of writing these books. You begin, and you know, I think this is absolutely unavoidable as a writer. I'd know this myself, and even in podcasting, is you do begin to build a certain form of identity and ego, and you have to continuously detach and deconstruct this thing that you've made. So then how do you think then you begin to kind of differentiate between the fictions you're creating and, you know, the real self? How have you found the real self in this process?
I mean, I think that a large part of my process then has been discovering aspects of myself by articulating them and then relinquishing them. So a lot of what I mean, because I mean, this is like almost like a psychotherapeutic process. Like I'm sorting the seeds of my own past, as I said, to separate, you know, what's true from what's false. But it seems as though, in a certain sense, this might oversimplify it. What's being articulated by definition is the false. As in, I suppose it's like being in a sauna or something. It's like the toxins are what are coming out. So, and you know, anything that gets written becomes fiction, doesn't it? I mean, it's kind of what you're saying. Even when you're podcasting, you create a form, you create a fixed image of yourself that becomes a product. Well, by definition, that's no longer you because you've already moved on. You have to have done, otherwise you would be trapped by the fiction, which I think does happen. I think that's what Strieber is unconsciously aware of. He's reframing it in a way that avoids the issue, I'd say. But I've written about this with Castaneda too. I think he became trapped in a certain way by those fictions, and maybe you know, anyone who does it to some extent. So yeah, the trick is, how do you neutralize that? And it's very tricky because it entails not being attached to the products, which is really hard, because if they're really true, if one is effective, they do seem like they're of great value, and I think potentially they are to other people, but I think their value primarily is of that they model a way of identifying the cultural implants or the personality traits we've adopted as a means to transcend them, let's say. But the transcendent itself has to happen off screen. You know, it can be behind between the lines in the transmission, but it can't ever be encapsulated in the words themselves, I would say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that is the nature of it, but it's very maddening in that regard. But maybe that's part of it, what you're saying. I mean, that would help us let go every time, as long as we keep reminding ourselves or being honest enough that we're not this, we're not the product of our, you know, we're not the sum of our memories, we're not the product of our conditioning, and we're not the, you know, we're more than the creations we create. Like, even if we were to create the greatest things in the world, being confined to that as an identity would be just as imprisoning.
Which leads to an extreme difficulty, because then the conditions are often almost self-referential. And this was the case for Whitley Strieber, in that he had this UFO experience, which it was extremely difficult to read this in the text because it's so convoluted that you realize how unstuck you could get. So he has this UFO experience, which he was in some sense, it seems quite vague to him still, but he has fairly rigorous memories of it. So he had this sort of abduction or just general UFO experience, which to him was entirely real and altered who he was, or altered his identity in some way. And yet the conditions themselves would disallow that condition. It would, the fictional conditions would state that is a fictional condition, if you can follow me there, you know.
Intuitively,
yeah. So with that kind of frame of reference where one condition is already telling you, like, no, your experience is not legitimate, you know, we all know the mainstream media's perspective on UFO, you know, they'd frame them as nuts or weirdos, etc. So already this experience has been delegitimized, and then you get into this strange perspective where you find it difficult to differ between kind of what is sane and what is insane, and then we get into kind of a once again into a loop, and it's very how did in writing this book, what kind of resources did you use and find to kind of stabilize oneself?
Right. Yeah, well, it seems like a good question. I mean, I think it's bringing me back to the trauma and the dissociation. And the main subject of the book is that. It's Strieber and even UFOs are secondary or tertiary subject matter of that book. It's really like I'm using Strieber and his experiences or his descriptions as a lens through which to look at the mechanism of trauma and dissociation. And of course that brings me to myself. Like if I'm going, you know, if I need to understand this, it's because it's something I myself have done, you know? So in what way am I traumatized? In what way am I dissociated? And how can I, you know, escape the dissociation and get back to the ground of the body? So there were things going on while I was writing that book that I include in the book, such as renovating the house, this house that we bought. And, you know, I include that because I needed to ground. See, the book is an analysis of a metafiction. So as I think you're pointing out, the book itself can become like another, you know, a rabbit hole within a rabbit hole if I'm not careful. Because that's what happens with language. It's like we build these mansions upon mansions, these matrices within matrices. So, I mean, I was aware that whatever was going on for me while I was writing that book in my lived life was going to be informing the book, whether or not I wrote about it, and vice versa, that writing the book would be informing my lived life, and that would be the objective. You know? That would be the main objective, was to try and bring myself out of this dream and back into reality. So there were things going on at the time, including the renovation of this house, that was forcing me to become more embodied and more aware of my physical reality and my limitations, which writing a book doesn't force you to. And on the contrary, it allows you to live in the imagination and to live in a realm where you have total control over, you know, the words and sentences and all the rest of it. You can create images and so on. I guess I had to try and communicate experience and then communicate the experience of being more in my body. And that would be that's the point of reference. I think possibly the only point of reference that I have, I won't speak for everyone, to contrast with the dissociative fantasy state or even thoughts or language, right? All the things that go into a book. One can write a book without any reference whatsoever to one's physical sensations. But actually when one is writing a book, one is having physical sensations. Something is going on in the body, whether we're noticing it or not. Now, reading a book can be a way to dissociate from the body because you're going off into the mind. But it can also be a way to tune into the body because it's relaxing and comfortable. And like I personally like to be I like to read in bed. I like to have a hot water bottle and so on. I like to be as physically comfortable as possible when I'm reading. And that's partly because reading itself allows me to really relax. So I want to collaborate with that process. So, I know that, I mean, this is sounding kind of strangely abstract, but you asked a very challenging question. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to get to the crux of it, which is, you know, what are we or where would we find ourselves once we start to emerge from a dissociated fantasy state? And how to communicate that in a book, which I think was kind of your question. And so the obvious literal way is, oh, I'm going to talk about what's going on. I'm going to talk about the actual act of writing or what, you know, how I'm renovating the house while I'm working on this book, to remind the reader that this book doesn't exist in a vacuum or in a void. They're not reading it in a void. It wasn't written in a void. And the same applies to any of our ideas about UFOs or philosophy or spirituality or occultism. They're just ideas, but they aren't occurring in a void. So they are ideas that potentially can bring us back to reality, just as they can take us further away from it. We can't, I don't think we can, like, I feel as though theory after another as a way to escape the horrible trauma of the experience. And what I was trying to do is reverse that trajectory and go all the way into the horror, but not as a horror fiction writer, but as a, you know, trauma survivor myself. And the horror isn't a story, it's just body affect. That's how I end Vice of Kings. It's the unbearable, or the echo of unbearable affect, what we're carrying in our body that can't be narrated, you know? It can't be reduced to a story.
Yeah, and this was one of the interesting things that really I was taken aback by, was that it becomes clear quite early on in the book that you aren't writing this in relation to trauma, which we'll get to in a moment, and not the specifics, but in abstract. But in relation to trauma, it seems to be tackled as this thing which isn't to be handled delicately. It's attacked head on, and as you said, you sort of, and I don't mean this in a kind of kitsch way, it's sort of like Colonel Kurtz, you know, heading directly upriver and not shying away from any aspect of it. There was no notion of a sort of, should we say, not to get too language based, but like there was no aspect of cognitive behavioral therapy type way of almost like employing these logical tricks to avoid it or mask it. It was like, let's rip off the plaster and look at this, not just the trauma itself, but what trauma actually is in abstract. And do you think that you found a way to define what it was for you?
Yes and no, I suppose. I think I had to write a whole book or a whole series of books to define it, which then makes it possible, or at least easier to define it, you know, in a few sentences. But again, trauma is a thing that can't be defined, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It can't actually be reduced to language, because it's almost as though one definition of trauma is what we generate language to protect ourselves from. That's one. There are many. It's almost like the Tao that can be named is not the true Tao comes to mind, because there's this book I quote in Prison Infinity a lot, that, you know, God is a, when the trauma becomes God, as in something that overwhelms us and seems to transcend our capacity to comprehend or even perceive as children, becomes a receptacle for religious ideation and imagery, right? Just as the UFO does. It's so much bigger than we can encapsulate with our mental reality, that from a mental perspective it seems like it's divine. But by that very token, the thing that we're naming isn't it. It's really a defense against it. It's interesting you use that metaphor about Colonel Kurtz, because I had used that temper briefly in my proposal for this upcoming book about Hollywood. I'd compared the book or myself to more to Willow than Kurtz, but going down the river. Mm-hmm. So it's funny you use that same metaphor. Yeah, I was curious, because I wasn't sure exactly what you're referring to when you were talking about how I tackled it head on. And I was wondering if you were also including in that the way that I tackled Whitley Strieber's trauma head on and didn't observe. I felt I ignored certain protocols there consciously. Like, this is quite impolite what I'm doing. It could be considered
invasive. Yeah, I wasn't gonna go, I was trying to be polite and not mention that you were impolite, but it was, and that's what I meant in a roundabout way by not employing I'm trying to find, I guess you just call it contemporary psychology, which is extremely polite. It's very British. Cognitive behavioral therapy is a sort of, it's a big plaque. As far as I see it, you know, it's a big pack of plasters which are just using these sort of subtle tricks of the mind to keep you going about your day, even though there's this thing. And Whitley Strieber, sort of, he ramps up his paranoia and his neuroticism to the point where he's making it so unavoidable, and he's going down every single avenue and sort of just turning up the paranoia to the point where he you know, he's facing it head on. And then you comment on this and remove any sort of kind of personable parts of Streber's work, and it becomes just this abstract journey, which is just both sides of it are abstract. So the person who's going on the journey is in abstract, and the journey itself is abstract, and it's just a complete kind of accelerated vision of trauma and a lot of paranoia, I think. But then, of course, I don't mean that in a sort of judging way. I mean that in a way that it may very well be justified.
Right.
Because that's one of the difficulties that comes across in the book, is that it's the difficulty of what's real and what's legitimate for yourself.
Yeah, and I felt, as I said in the book, that I was taking Streber at his word and taking him as seriously as he wanted to be taken, and so I felt I could just take the kid gloves off there and not hold back. Like, if he really believes all this, then, and he wants us to look at it, then let's look at it. And if it exposes some deep trauma wound in himself, well, so be it. I mean, that, if he's being sincere, then he would want to see that.
Yeah, well, I think there's something important in viewing that perspective and going, right, let's, whether or not it's fiction or paranoia or neurosis or a trauma, let's run with the fiction and see what's unturned. I mean, it was strangely coincidental, as when I was reading Prisoner of Infinity for the first time, that was when, I'm sure you've seen it, this new information about the Finders came out. And I was like, you know, there's this sudden sort of one of the I guess you'd call it power structures or institutions in society, the CIA, is like releasing these documents and then legitimizing this fiction, which for so long was a fiction, you know. And it's a strange, a very, very strange mixture, but it follows the upriver journey.
Well, as I say, I don't know if I'd frozen, but I used that metaphor. I did use it for myself for my writing recently in a proposal. So, yeah, I'm not averse to it. I think it can be futile. It can be self-destructive as well. So it really is a fine line. I mean, one of the ways I've described what I've done in these recent books is like a mad scientist who infects himself with a mutating virus or whatever to see what it will do, because that's the only way he can observe, you know, find out actually what it's capable of and find the cure. He has to actually give himself the disease. And I feel like I've done that unconsciously, you know, from childhood onward, taking on movie lore and movie culture and one bad role model after another, one, you know, mimetic model after another. I have infected myself with these cultural viruses, but at a certain point I started doing it more consciously in a way. Obviously I was already infected by Streber when I started writing Prisoner Infinity, but I had to totally immerse myself in Streber's world in order to write that book. So I was, yeah, willingly submitting to something I'd already identified as toxic at that point.
So did you afterwards find any clear difference between consciously and unconsciously submitting to a cultural virus?
Well, it's actually happening now for me as well, with this book about Hollywood, which is about Hollywood secret society and movie culture. I'm watching even more movies and TV shows than usual, and now I've got the perfect, you know, rationale for doing so. Now it's research, in quotes. But it has been for years. I mean, I've had that rationale for years. I don't only have that rationale. I know that I do it to relax and escape as well. But there is that added element of, oh, I'm discovering, you know, more about the nature of this virus and more clues about how to combat it, let's say. With the weird paradox that I'm constantly, you know, re-exposing myself to it. So however, you know, much I develop immunity, I might need more immunity because I'm being more and more exposed. It could be, a vicious circle in that regard, but I'm hoping it isn't. And I'm guessing that what happens over time is that one does develop immunity because one sees more and more clearly the ways in which one is being manipulated and lied to. And so although one might still be submitting because there's that personal incentive to do so, suspending disbelief, whether it's movies, TV shows, or Whitley Strieber or Castaneda or Aleister Crowley, or a lot of spirituality even, or religion and so on. What was I saying? We do it. We still want to submit because we get the dissociative high. We become more and more conscious of doing so, and so it becomes over time less and less effective. You know, we're less and less able to lose ourselves in it. And maybe the cognitive dissonance gets greater as well. Like, the more I learn about Hollywood, the more disorienting it is, was with Strieber as well, to find myself falling under this spell while at the same time another part of me is screaming, don't do it, you know this is a lie, why are you believing it? That's a very interesting thing to observe in oneself, and I think it's been going on my whole life. It's just that voice that was saying don't do it, I couldn't hear it. I shouldn't say it's screaming now because I don't think that would be helpful, but I'm more tuned into it, and so it's more emphatically saying, well, don't forget,
yeah, I wonder,
don't forget what you know.
I wonder what would happen when you, if it was ever possible, or if someone has, or when you could sort of get to a point where every conditioned exercise you're taking part in is you're constantly aware of, I guess it would be a sort of pseudo enlightenment where every condition of society is just this constant questioning, and I'm not sure how helpful that would be. With regards to this Hollywood book, obviously you've written a couple of other books. What is the, is this sort of the spells that Hollywood is putting on us, or the things they're trying to make us think, or what's the direction here?
I mean, you haven't read Seen Not Seen, so you don't know my take on movies, but if you had, I could say, well, if you put all those three books together and splice them into one massive book, without repeating myself, it's new material, you'd have a sense. So it's like, the agenda is very, very deep. And I think maybe we can get to Girard and Lloyd DeMaus and Kowshed here, because I think Hollywood is just the latest iteration of something that is not just ancient, but prehistorical. Like, I have this book, Power of Ritual in Prehistory by Brian Hayden, and I just came upon it when I was finishing my book, and I realized, well, his thesis is compatible with mine, and he's talking about prehistorical secret societies and the way they use theater and enactments and alteration of consciousness in order to manage society and even create, organize social structures in order to empower themselves and extend their power and influence and network and so on. This is really, this is beyond the deep state. This is like the deep human state.
Yeah.
This is just something so fundamental to human psychology and human organization. And I think Hollywood's just the latest iteration, like we were talking about at the beginning. It's now very visible, and it's becoming conscious. People are aware, number one, I think they're becoming more aware that Hollywood is a propaganda machine. And number two, they're definitely becoming more aware that it conceals, the glamour of Hollywood conceals no end of endemic abuses of power, including organized child abuse. Mm-hmm. So that, how do we reconcile that? How do we reconcile those two and all those three? That Hollywood, the product is both entertaining and manipulative or brainwashing, and that it's inseparable from a hidden social aspect that we would consider, or we do consider, to be abhorrent, to be immoral. Those questions obviously they're contemporary, so they're quite surface. People must be having them at a surface level, but I think they also go back to how society and culture has come about, and I mean the way in which it's formed, the matrix out of which it's formed, which I think is the trauma matrix.
Okay, so a couple of questions. One quick one, which is the book that you mentioned there about prehistory, is that relating to sort of Atlantis, Lemuria, and Sumerian?
No. Yeah, no, he's not speculating about any... when he says prehistory, he just means as in pre-records, but there's archaeological records, so okay. It's based on archaeological findings.
And the second thing here relating... If I could take an abstract stab at a potential sort of example, if we were to take something such as Game of Thrones as a very, very clear base level example of a mass culturally prolific example of, you know, something that everyone is watching. If we take this as a ritual, as a display of symbols and characters and actors and a narrative which is being subconsciously put across, in this sense, would the kind of conclusions and the messages that such a show is putting across, would that be the occulted spell which is being cast out by Hollywood? Is that roughly at a base level the target here, or am I completely
No, you're not off base, but one could break it down and analyze and say, well, there's that, you know, this is a succession drama, and so it has the supernatural element, and it has, well, whatever. I mean, I don't want to focus on the minutiae because I'll lose my main point, but that stuff could be analyzed by taking Game of Thrones as a separate cultural artifact and just breaking it apart, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And I've done that. I mean, in my early movie, my first writings, Blood Poets, I did that. But what I'm talking about, one couldn't do that just by breaking down the cultural artifact. One has to create the historical context for it. First of all, the cultural history, as in movies and TV shows, and then even further back, and that would go back through Dadaism and Surrealism and occultism and Theosophy and so on. I mean, I haven't mapped all of this, but I have noticed certain trends and themes. And this is a much subtler kind of thing, which is, and it's impossible, I think, to separate the ideological content from the aesthetic as well. So, I mean, I've realized over recent years that the ideology of occultism, the will to power, let's say, is kind of inseparable from the aesthetics of it. So there are many of us who have received the aesthetics of this ideology, whatever we're going to call it, without actually adopting the ideology. But if we take on the aesthetics, say we dress like goths, right, as teenagers, we're taking on the aesthetics of occultism there. There's, you know, there's a vampire thing and you know, slightly satanic black magic and so on, right? It's there in the aesthetics. We might not be adopting an ideology, we might not become occultists or Satanists or anything like that, but by taking on the aesthetics, that's like a, you know, a shoehorn or a thin end of a wedge. Because we're imitating something that actually is part of a deeper tradition that we don't recognize. So that's what I mean. Like with Game of Thrones, one could look at the different elements and so on, but one wouldn't necessarily understand them because we've already been so indoctrinated, mm-hmm. both ideologically and aesthetically, that we don't even recognize, So the poisons that we're imbibing.
It's beyond even the fact that we don't recognise that... So if you were to analyse Game of Thrones, that would be incorrect because you would be analysing a minute part of the fact that this desire to even view this kind of stuff or to desire this aesthetic is... You should be criticising where that desire came from. Why have I even got this desire? Who or what or why has this been put here, you know. It's a desire which hasn't, I have no real proof, has originated with me.
Yeah, that's right. And Game of Thrones, one thing that comes to mind about Game of Thrones as a specific example was the Red Wedding thing, which is that, you know, people, when all those characters were slaughtered, people were traumatized by it, in quotes. They felt as though they'd been traumatized. I question whether someone can actually be traumatized by a TV show or by fiction, but one could certainly be triggered. And if people are triggered, that's because they've got past trauma and they feel like they're traumatized because they're re-experiencing a trauma in the past, which is my theory about Whitley, what happened with Whitley. So the fact is there is that people found great value in Game of Thrones for them, not even despite, but I would say because they found it triggering, they found it so upsetting. And that's what we look for from fiction. We want it to really impact us in a way that, you know, sweeps us off our feet and out of our ordinary mundane lives, which we feel oppressed by, into another world where things are more intense and exciting. And so Game of Thrones did that, but at a certain point it changed courses. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to make a point with this, but it's just an observation. It departed from the books partly just out of, you know, impatience and greed because mm-hmm. the books weren't written. But I'd say it's also an inevitable degeneration that happens with TV shows. I've observed it more and more now, which is they just get lazy and they just get lazy, basically. Mm-hmm. And they lose the plot, literally, in the case of Game of Thrones. But one of the things that went was that this method that the writer had, or this willingness he had to just do away with leading key characters, just like reality, people die in mm-hmm. the world he's depicting, people would die horribly all the time. So he stayed true to that. Well, the TV show departed from that. And so it lost this basic core of reality. And it wasn't just in that way, of course. I think that the writing deteriorated and therefore the acting deteriorated because actors can't act well with terrible dialogue, and the plot came apart. You know, I stopped watching it after, I think, 5 seasons or something, and I kept trying again because I'd liked it so much to begin with, but I kept being appalled by how much it had deteriorated. And it's interesting to speculate about that, because it may have been that one of the ways that the audience went along with that and didn't notice it was that they'd been so disturbed by the reality of it that they were almost grateful that it just deteriorated into an ordinary TV show at a certain point, and they were able to enjoy the dragons and the battles and so on, but didn't have to experience the intensity of the previous levels. That would suggest, I don't know, that, you know, I guess there's at least two things going on there. One, that you know, people need their entertainment to be somewhat traumatizing or to feel like it is, to be sufficiently distracting. But like in real life, once you, you know, at a certain point, it gets overwhelming, and so you just want to avoid reality entirely.
Yeah, so. A friend of mine said that Game of Thrones finally became a series worthy of its audience. You know, so the unconscious kind of, because it's obviously one of the most popular. Ridiculously popular shows, and it just so you know, by the end of series 8, it turns more into an assemblage of sort of blueprints of just classic TV events sewn together so poorly that it almost seems that just half of it has been left on the shelf, and you really it's worth watching for the disbelief of how that could have. You could have gone from series 1 to season 8.
Yeah, and what happens through that process? You know, they talk about dumbing down audiences. Well, that would be a way to do it in record time, as you create a TV series, get people totally invested that they won't want to, they'll want to keep watching no matter what, and then they won't want to see the fact it's deteriorating, because that obviously, then they'd have to consider not watching. So they'll keep filling in the papering over the cracks. They'll keep reducing their level of discernment in order to stay with them.
Yeah.
And I think that's a level of psychological manipulation which transcends propaganda, right? Propaganda itself sabotages our power to discern. And that might be more important than what we're actually believing because we're not discerning, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. This was one of the things I recently spoke about with John Michael Greer again, that one of the key symptoms of modernity's conditioning is this inability. We were talking about this in relation to consumerism, which isn't, you know, massively far from what we're talking about here, which is people's inability as conditioned to view suffering and death are viewed as wholly bad. They are things that shouldn't exist. We shouldn't see them. They're not things. They're definitely not things that should be willingly undertaken. So it seems that there's a connection there, that the dumbing down is a way to make us feel as if everything, you know, everything's like, as you mentioned, the main characters stop dying. It gets comfortable. It gets dumbed down, and it gets kind of so easy to consume that there's no. It's now just consumption of content, as opposed to even, it's almost like the Warhol moment of no one's actually looking at the paintings. They're just going to see, to say they saw it, as opposed to actually look at it. You know, people now kind of tally up all the shows and all the content they've viewed and all the films, you know, but don't really have anything of substance to say about the things they've watched.
Yeah. So then becomes this empty ritual where they get to think, I'm going to watch Game of Thrones now, and they get to have the experience of watching Game of Thrones without engaging. It becomes entirely passive at that point.
Yeah. Even, well, TV's a fairly passive medium, I think.
It is. It is already. But if you're having strong emotional responses, then you're at least engaged internally, right?
Yeah.
At least there's some. And I think, you know, I think what you're underscoring there is what I've called the disembodiment agenda, and it's described in Prisoner Infinity, this drive towards disembodiment, because, of course, where does suffering and death happen? It happens in the body. Not that it can't happen in some disembodied realm, it certainly can, but we have this primary association of suffering and obviously death. If our physical suffering, as in the case of trauma, is overwhelming, that's what we do, we dissociate from the body. And of course, that makes us primed for entertainment media. That's exactly, that's a manufactured dissociation device, if you will. That gives you the raw material of fantasy without even having to generate it yourself. And it allows you to dissociate, you know, at the click of a button. So then it makes sense that the dissociative fantasies would be constantly reminding us of our body, pain and suffering and death. It's sort of paradoxical, but fairy tales were like that too, aren't they? Because we're sort of trying to bring ourselves back to our body, but we're also, it's like in the Matrix movie, they said they gave them a perfect fantasy and the pods rejected the program, right? They started dying in the pods. So then they had to create a Matrix that had suffering in it so that people would believe it. So it's, I think we do need a level of entertainment that sufficiently real that it can distract us, but it still has to have the fantasy element, you know, to serve as an escape mechanism.
So do you think that kind of societally, you know, easily accessible and affordable virtual reality would be a real kind of death blow to any, you know, if TV is doing this to us to the point of disembodiment, then do you think that then, you know, the next stage VR would be the real, almost turning us into just a satire of the couch potato?
Well, I said we're learning to walk and talk while we're on our cell phones now, aren't we? So it's as ever, it evolves and unfolds in ways that our science fiction doesn't quite predict. So I think it is. I think there is that happening, but I think it's not quite as simple as just, you know, people plugged in their spinning chairs in front of their computers, like ordering pizza or being intravenously fed. It might come to that, but currently it seems as though we're developing a society and a technology and a psychology by which we can continue to interact in our daily lives while being more and more, having our attention more and more on the virtual. So it's almost like being possessed then. It's like we get possessed by technology and our technology starts using us to move around.
This, yeah, and this would tie into the kind of theory that the sort of strange materialist theory that capitalism is actually infecting us and just using us for its own end, or some, or at least something from the outside is historically using us for an end game, which is already in the future, but we've just got to make it real. So you know, that kind of ties into this overarching thing you were mentioning with Hollywood. You know, I think if something has a directive and a motive which is indiscernible, a good question would be, what do you think the end game, the point of this historical force which is now within Hollywood, what do you see the point of that for it?
Well, I suppose one could approach it from two angles, like to try and discern the purpose and thereby deduce what it is. Or one could say, well, first of all, we need to figure out what it is, you know, even to say if it has a purpose. I think speculating that it comes from outside or assuming that it is very tempting, but I think it's risky. It does seem to be an anti-life program, I'll say that much, and therefore its end game appears to be total disembodiment, for humans to become totally disembodied and therefore vehicles for possession by it. And then eventually, I suppose, eradication of the human bodies and the I don't know, actually. I mean, at that point, my you know, we've got so many sci-fi movies predicting this. That,
exactly, you don't know whether or not you're being
infected. Trust my imagination. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. I was just saying, bring it back to the question of whether it's outside or not, because clearly, whether it came from outside, clearly it's in us now. That's the whole point. And it does seem like it's something that's possessing us, so that suggests it must have come from outside. But I'm not sure if that's true. I think that it's possible that trauma genetically, we as a species, an individual, we have generated this false identity out of the substance of our own organism, psychically and physically. So it's like an implant, I mean, like a tumor, a cancer tumor. Does that come from outside? Well, yes and no. I mean, the environment might have generated it or might have created the conditions by which we've generated this tumor that kills us, but it's still generated internally out of our own life force and our own, you know, physical stock. So I think it's something like that. I think it's a combination of our environment with our internal reaction to it that has generated something within us that doesn't belong there and that needs to be expelled. And that in the meantime, it really does develop its own agenda. It seems like it becomes autonomous, and so then its attempt is to possess us. But that is inseparable from its attempt to destroy us. It can't possess us without destroying us. So then it tries to use us to create these machine bodies, which it can then migrate to, perhaps. And then that's where I start getting very speculative. But something like that does seem to be happening as we're creating more and more technological extensions of ourselves and then putting ourselves in them as if we're trying to escape our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't, I mean, what would the end game be to that? Because eventually we wouldn't even be able to feed ourselves or survive.
I guess at that point you would say that the end game is this, the outside force in quotes is so inhuman that our means of articulation and understanding in relation to what it wants to, you know, do is so not human that we're not going to be able to kind of comprehend why it might, you know, its meaning to why it might want to do something. You know, we have human things that we want to do, and they make sense to us, but they probably wouldn't make sense to a computer, right. You know. or a machine, or
and this is, but this is part of the dreams of occultism too. I mean, Kenneth Grant, he believed that the next phase of human evolution would be a beetle consciousness would take over the planet, and also Whitley with his visitors, they're our future selves, and yet they're these kind of insectoid beings that have no qualms about viciously traumatizing us to help us evolve. Some very dark visions have been rationalized, I think, by the proponents of them with just that argument, that something that transcended us, you know, in every way would be incomprehensible to us and therefore indistinguishable to us from something malign.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so this line of thinking kind of rides heavily on whether or not the human is actually important in relation to the cosmos. Because if we're not important, then this whole thing is, you know, in terms of comprehensibility, it wouldn't matter to the cosmos. If we are important, then we could be asking, well, why are we, you know, where are we going? But these are extremely big questions. But I think one of the important things that you briefly mentioned there is, when we get to these conclusions about the next stage, or the we're going to have our minds uploaded into AI programs, etc., there is always that thought of, I'm sure I've thought of that or seen that somewhere before. So once again, there's the idea of like, well, hang on, has this been planted, you know, so to speak, by this Hollywood thing once again? Sort of like, you know, it's the classic example, but like the film They Live is, you know, these constant little things to make you accept and assimilate into the plan of the other.
And also to bring it about. So that's, scenario planning is something that NASA, I think it was Herman Kahn, came up with that term. But anyway, for many decades, that's been a methodology that NASA and presumably other intelligence agencies and corporations now employ, which is you work out the kind of future technology or social developments you want that will advantage you, or that you see as advantaging your clique, because I don't think it's ever about humanity in total. And then you seed the culture with both the belief in those things and the desire for them. Mm-hmm. And then you create generations that will, or individuals within generations who will make them happen. Right? So like the phone, the what you call them in Star Trek, whatever they call those things, yeah, that they spoke in Star Trek, they eventually took form with cell phones. Well, because they were designed by people who grew up on Star Trek, perhaps.
Right? Yeah. So the term hyperstition is the becoming real of fictions in this way.
Right. Right. Which is back to Whitley, isn't it? And that term, I mean, that encompasses a very, very broad spectrum, doesn't it? Because you got, and I try and stay in the nuts and bolts of things, ironically, because I was always an anti-nuts and bolts to when it comes to UFOs. I still am, except I think it's secret weaponry of, you know, intelligence agencies. But besides that aspect, there is a metaphysical element to our lives, and it's not as though that is primary to me. But I mean, in terms of understanding what's going on socio-politically, I try and keep it grounded as much as possible in something we can all agree on, that we can touch and taste and smell. And so at that end of the spectrum, yeah, hyperstition, as I just described with scenario planning, it can be understood in quite mundane terms. It's very sophisticated, and it maybe is beyond what most conspiracy theorists, well, actually they're pretty wild and out there, aren't they? But I mean, it's a subtler level of social engineering than just, you know, men in rooms plotting, although it includes that aspect. But at the other end of the spectrum, it is somebody like Strieber, or even Peter Lavender, who I quote in the book, who I think is also very suspect and deceptive kind of agent of information, arguing that if we create fictions convincing enough, they will become real because we're generating reality through our own psyches. Well, that's a kind of that's a thought stopper and a sort of argument ender, really, because if we just allow that onto the table, then we risk solipsism, number one, and number two, I suppose, simulation theorists or something. We might end up in that, I would say, trap of just saying, well, it's all simulated anyway, so then we're just generating reality, so compared to what? And I don't know where to position myself on that.
Well, because, there's no way to position yourself there, because then in any structure or stratified thing is suspect. Because is it every single thing a fiction, which is simply being maintained? Which I think is, when I spoke to Eric Davis about, and we mentioned Deleuze and Guattari, he says, you know, that they really pushed the limits to this, but they did also very, very briefly mention you do always need to retain some territory. You know, you have to, like you said, it's at the end of the day, from all this, you can still say it's still Corbyn versus Johnson or Trump versus, you know, Sanders. You know, there's, you need to keep hold somewhere.
Right. So, well, that's where I try and bookend the religious positions. Well, maybe where I'm interested in Girard, because I do acknowledge a use for the word God. Let me put it that way. I think it's a meaningful word. It can be used meaningfully. I do use it sometimes. But I say I bookend that with trauma. Like, to me, the indispensable marker of reality is not Donald Trump. it's trauma, and it's not identity. I mean, interesting, I found out recently that the devolution of postmodernism into identity politics, or whatever we have today going on in the world, in academia specifically, centers around this choice of what you were just saying, that the one thing they have to keep keep reifying and keep, you know, assigning an empirical existence to is identity. And I think that that's the worst mistake we could make in a certain sense, but perhaps a necessary one.
Is it, you point out a strange paradox for the academies and institutions being, because as far as I can kind of see, as someone who's just finished their master's in continental philosophy, the backbone of a lot of academic thought is current Foucault and Derrida and French kind of deconstruction. And so the deconstruction of identity, yet the irony that you pointed out there is that at the same time, they still need to maintain, you have to maintain the structure which allows you to destructure things, which is so that they have to legitimize themselves whilst delegitimizing kind of everything else. Because without, you know, they don't deconstruct themselves. There's a difficulty there.
Well, there is, because how can you be professional? It's like what I was saying about my books. They end up risking negating themselves or dissolving themselves somehow, because I'm trying to use writing to expose writing as a.
But I think that's where the impoliteness comes in, the blunt, often very blunt and kind of brute force. You turn the page and there is a sort of huge quote, and then you'll jump right in, and there's no sort of pretense or academic justification. There's connections, and then it'll jump into the next section, and there's definite connections, but it's sort of this continuous barrage without restraint and without mercy, and it's like a statement which there's going to be your own conclusion, but like you said, it's very impolite. And I think that's important, that if something's being too polite, you have to sort of, like, the academy is polite, so you have to sort of wonder if something's being polite, then I think that they are doing so because they need the people they're being polite to believe or think of them in a certain way. And if you don't care about how people think of you, then it's, I think, you know, that's a good way.
You can afford to be impolite, yeah, mm-hmm. It's doing unto others, isn't it? And of course, polite is politic. It's the same root. And identity politics is all about be polite. I mean, beyond that, it's actually, you must validate and enable my delusion, you know, my assertion of being the sovereign of my own reality. I can't afford to. I mean, if I'm writing to dissolve my own identity, essentially, or to, you know, see through it, to see the structure of it, and therefore see what's beyond it, and of course, I can't afford to be polite about other people's identities. I mean, it wouldn't. Not that it wouldn't occur to me, because it does. I mean, it occurred to me, well, Whitley's not going to like this, but I want it. I want it to reach him.
But in saying that it's impolite, I don't think it's actively impolite. It's more of a, it is as it is. I don't think it's actively hateful. Just because you're not polite, polite doesn't mean that you're, you don't like the person. It's just like, this is how it is.
No, it's respectful. It's absolutely respectful, but it's my idea of respect. And it breaks an unwritten agreement in academia and beyond, which is you don't call people out on their bullshit. Essentially, I think that's a social agreement, isn't it? As the whole of society, really.
Yeah.
But you can't afford to have that in academia. It's ridiculous. It's absurd.
Well, you can't afford to have the...
You can't afford to have an agreement not to call people out on their bullshit in academia. At that point, it's become, crystalized as an institution, trying to preserve it.
That is most definitely happening. And I think they're finding that what's happening because of that politeness is that they now have to legitimize contradictions. So there can now be two existing contradictions within the academy, and no one will bat an eye because everything has to be tolerated.
Right, and everyone's point of view is equally valid, which is, of course, the death of academia and logic and
truth.
It's sort of compatible with postmodernism, but I don't know postmodernism and wellness, but it's certainly New Ageism.
I think the word postmodernism gets battered around, and I think it's a bit more specific than people want to think.
I try not to use it now because
I think really it's too just quickly. Kind of identity politics. I think is there's plenty of names for it,
but it definitely has been around quite a long time, and certainly you could see in the early strains of New Age, and I'd say occultism. I think there are definitely aspects of occultism that's about create your own reality. There is that aspect. Again, one can terms, they mutate and change all the time. So what John Michael Greer means by occultism clearly is not what I mean by it. And I don't know where we would get to in a conversation.
Well, I think he openly states that you ask two occultists what it is, I think you're going to have differing opinions. I would say that the problem with the academy's thing there is, I'm fairly well read on occult history, but maybe you could think of some examples where this has happened. But it seems that the occultist kind of sovereign individual at least hasn't molded with politics. So they are more than happy, it seems, to kind of keep to themselves, So in that sense, I don't really mind, because I don't... If someone's away from me creating their own reality, I don't care as long as I don't have to get involved. As soon as people are creating a reality and demanding that I adhere to it, that's when I sort of have a problem with it.
Isn't that a bit like a virus that's just hasn't landed on you yet?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Because it's still being generated, potentially.
And if you develop an immunity to that virus, then you're sort of shunned because the virus is popular. It's cool to have a cold.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure where we can continue this conversation. We've sort of blitzed.
Well, I think one of the things we circle back to is identity, isn't it? The centrality of identity. And I think that if I had to name the anti-life force, I'd probably name it that, identity. I mean, it's false identity, but then the question is, what's a true identity? Like, how do we identify truly with what?
Well, one of the few gems that I've had on this podcast in terms of was Dmitry Orlov, who I didn't expect it from him, no offense to him, but he said that the majority of people these days are simply a culmination of their vices. And I think that's a good place to begin thinking about what your identity actually is. Strip away all the trinkets, the vices, the products, then start thinking what's there. And I think that's a good place to kind of start.
Well, as Dostoevsky said, something a little bit similar. If we were to lose our habits, we would become gods. not that I'm advocating becoming gods, but in the sense of being free of vices and equating habits with vices. Yeah, I'd say it was as routines we have. We have routines of thought and behavior which aren't healthy or life enhancing. There's ordinary routines, I've got nothing against them, like brushing my teeth and stuff. But in terms of routinary ways of engaging with reality that don't need to be routine, as in, you know, I've got to brush my teeth every day, or I think I do because of tooth decay. But most of the routine I have for engaging with reality they're not based on any logical understanding or respect for reality, physical reality. They're internalized trauma programs, I'd say, as in they're preempting an imaginary trauma which has already happened.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, but there was a small thing came up on Twitter, actually, and it seemed that a lot of people agreed, which is, I've recently read an essay by Ranpreet, where he is, basically his long story short is that the education system and Western schools is entirely child abuse. And if you think it isn't, then they've got their claws very deep. And it makes me, you know, wonder if everyone didn't have that preliminary, what is it, roughly kind of 16 years of existence, where you are, like you said, put into these routines of ways to interact with reality, you know, what you'd probably just be put into some other routines, parental routines, etc. But it's something to think about, I think.
Yeah, well, it certainly starts with the family, obviously the ones very formative experiences, but you could, I mean, schools and organizations, institutions can't be separated from that. They're generated by human beings and groups who themselves have been conditioned through their early parenting trauma experiences, trauma and otherwise. So that's the Lloyd DeMaus model of psychohistory, really. So yeah, we could say that the school indoctrination system and the military and other things they're just, you know, developments or concretizations of the even earlier programmings that occur in through parenting. Where it all began is the, you know, is the impossible question. Yeah. It's presumably just incremental over hundreds of thousands of years.
So you're working on this. Do you know is there a title for this book, this new book on Hollywood?
It's currently called 16 Maps of Hell with a Rough Draft of the Exit, but I have a feeling that any publisher might object to that kind of playful title. Hollywood Secret Society is the subtitle, so some sort of variation of those different elements. But yeah, my goal was to use Hollywood as a means to map the contemporary equivalent of hell that we've generated for ourselves and end on a positive note, as in there is actually a way out. Like, if we really understand the terrain of hell, then we can locate the point we entered, and then we've found the way out.
Okay. And do you, the horrible question, what kind of stage is it at?
Oh, it's that's not so horrible. Oh. It's mostly done. Oh, I'm okay. Just kind of bashing it out with an agent and seeing, I'm cautiously optimistic about reaching a wider audience because of the subject matter and because of the timing. Because I'm a very marginal author, like a few hundred readers kind of thing. Currently, I'm in the bracket of academic, or that level of academic readership, even though I'm not an academic writer and I don't have academic readers. But I mean, in terms of sheer numbers, or mere numbers, that's the level I'm at in terms of my reach. So I do have this burning desire to reach a larger audience, but whether or not I'll ever achieve that, or whether it's going to be worth achieving, I don't know.
That's quite a somber point to finish on, unless there's anything you'd like to add.
Well, I suppose a lighter point would be that I'm having a blast doing it anyway, and I do think that, you know, anything we really fully engage in, that portion of the life force we have access to gets engaged, and then that accumulates, like the rest of our life force starts getting drawn in by that engagement. So writing for me is that, even though it seems like a mental pursuit, I'd say it's one that I pursue more and more with all of my body parts.
Okay, thanks very much.
Well, thanks, James, for the invitation, and I enjoyed the chat, and I said we could maybe do a follow-up on the Limmer list.